Good morning, my happy little ramblers, and welcome to Rhys Rambles, episode 62, of course, the official podcast of Control Alt Rhys. And indeed, another weekend is upon us. Where do they keep, where do these weeks keep disappearing to? I haven't actually been in the studio all week since last weekend, since I finished off my Doom video, which of course I will talk about shortly. Bit of an interesting experiment for the channel, and yeah, one that didn't go quite so well, so that's quite interesting. But yeah, I'm back here at the studio today. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to be recording this afternoon. I had a load of stuff arrive, a load of stuff for projects and some things that I'm supposed to be looking at. So I really need to get on with those. But of course, the ramble always comes first on a Friday because I need to get it out there. I need to get it released in time, 2 minutes to midnight UK time on a Friday night. And on that note, yeah, there was a bit of an issue last week, a bit of a scheduling issue. So apologies to my audio listeners who listen to this on the various podcast platforms. Well, we'll take a look at this. So this is how I upload my audio episode. So what I do with this is just some technical stuff, just in case you're interested. I record all of this live into OBS as if it was like a live stream. I have an Elgato cam link that I use to capture the output from the camera, and I have a screen capture thing that I use for recording the screen. Of course, I'm addressing the audio listeners here, so I'm not quite sure why I'm explaining all this, because they will have never have seen any of this. But so I record it all live, and I record it as video, very quickly chop it up. I don't really spend a lot of time editing this nowadays. I used to try and edit out all of the ums and the ers and the breath noises and stuff like that. But I like to think I've got better at all that kind of stuff. But I very roughly chop it up, put the flash transition between each section, and that's it. I've never really bothered with jingles and random noises and stuff like that. I mean, you know, it's like talk radio, isn't it? That's what it is. That's the kind of vibe that I'm going for. But once the episode is done, I export it as a video file and also as an audio file. And the video file gets uploaded to YouTube using YouTube Studio, of course, which I've talked about many times in the past, like I do for all of my videos. And the audio file gets uploaded via this service here, which is actually Spotify for podcasters. So I signed up with Spotify initially, and basically, I mean, I'm sure it has a lot of other functionality, but as far as I'm concerned, it's literally just a way to shove podcast episodes out there. And it generates an RSS feed, and all the other podcasting platforms pick up on that feed. Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts and whatever else. There's people listening on platforms that I've never even heard of. And yeah, once an episode pops up in the feed, it takes a while. Obviously, that those services are constantly sort of polling all of the different feeds for all of the different podcasts. They spot that there's a new episode on there, and they grab it from Spotify and they rehost it on their own service, I think is how it works technically behind the scenes. And this is all free. It doesn't cost me anything. But of course, that's all reliant on me actually uploading the episode in the first place. And then I have to go through a list of questions. I have to fill in a title and a description, and I can add artwork, which I never bothered doing, but apparently you can add like specific artwork for each episode. And then there's like a scheduling thing at the end, and I have to pick a time when I want it to go live. And then I have to press a big purple button that says schedule, or schedule if you're American. My light's just gone off. No. Then it's queued up and ready to go out. And I got all the way through to the end of that process, and I was so busy sorting out the YouTube version, the video version of the podcast, and making sure that was all scheduled properly, that I didn't actually do the very last step, which is clicking the button. And I had a few messages from people saying, oh, is there no ramble this week? And I had some comments on the YouTube version as well, asking if there was some kind of issue. And the only issue was me. I just forgot to click the button. So there you go. That's why that ended up being delayed. And by the way, this podcast goes out at 11:58 PM UK time every Friday night, just as a bit of a reminder. And for anyone who is new, 2 minutes to midnight, of course, fantastic Iron Maiden song. And there's actually an interesting reason for that. And the reason for that, yet again, is because I'm not a very smart man. Because was it once or did it happen a couple of times? Obviously, I've been doing these every single week for over a year now. I've done 62 of them. And there have been a couple of times in the past where I tried to schedule these. And I used to schedule them for midnight. And I would... one of the services, I think it's YouTube. I think Spotify uses 24-hour clock. But whichever one it is, one of the services uses 12-hour clock for some reason. Now, I hate 12-hour clock. I don't like the ambiguity of it. It's easy enough to tell the time using a 24-hour clock. But a couple of times I scheduled it I scheduled it for 12. But midnight, is it 12 a.m. or is it 12 p.m.? Well, I get very easily confused, and yeah, there was more than one occasion where I clicked the wrong option and it ended up going out in the middle of the day and just confusing everyone. So that's why I decided 11:58 p.m. There's no ambiguity there, and obviously that's 23:58 on the other service. Completely, you know, uninteresting background information, but there you go. And speaking of uninteresting background information, let's talk about this video that's gone out this week. I've got loads of stuff in my list of things to talk about, so we'll rattle through them for a change. But yes, I've had a video that went out this week, and it is this one, which was about my Doom collection and about me unboxing a new item that arrived for that collection. I won't spoil it for you if you haven't seen it. And there's quite an interesting story behind this. If you're watching this on YouTube, you can probably see the absolutely abysmal analytics. I actually initially recorded this as a second channel video, and I mean, if you haven't seen it, I'm basically showing off a load of stuff that I have in my my Doom collection of stuff relating to Doom, the game, mostly various versions and copies of the game. And I recorded the whole thing, and I thought, I want to get some nice close-up shots of stuff. So I came in last weekend, and I set everything up on the desk, and I got some really nice close-up shots of everything, got it all really well lit, and I was really, really pleased with them, just the lighting and the, you know, using manual focus on the camera to make sure it was properly dialed in perfectly, and really cool. And you know, that it's all, as is usually the case with the second channel, it's all kind of practicing skills that I use for the main channel eventually. And I sat and I watched the video and I thought, this is too good for the second channel. And, you know, I mean, what is the criteria for stuff that goes out on this channel? Just anything that I don't think is quite up to, well, maybe not quite up to the standard of the main channel, but stuff that I just haven't put as much work into, I guess. I want an outlet for, you know, sometimes I just want to point a camera at something and just record it and just show everyone and just say, look at this, isn't it cool? And not have to spend days and days editing it and doing music and transitions and titles and talking about the whole history and backstory of it. Sometimes I just want to show off some cool stuff. And obviously there is a core audience of people who watch this second channel who enjoy that stuff, which is, of course, you know, very much appreciated. But with this one, I just thought, no, this one's probably got some wider appeal. Obviously, I've done the Doom on the desk thing. The desk videos have been massively successful. That initial one, running Doom on the desk, has 8,200 views now. As you can see, I've made £18.80 in ad revenue from that. So the desk cost me £30 plus the cost of fuel to get to Birmingham. But yeah, if you look at the second follow-up video, that one's made £33.65 and it's got 13,500 views. So yeah, between those, we've got, you know, what, about 50? Yeah, about 50 quid. So yeah, that just about covers the cost of the desk and the travel to go and pick it up. Obviously not the time that I could have been working in my day job earning money, but we don't do that. My time is worthless. But yeah, with those in mind, 8,200 views and then 13,500 views. And this was a more kind of old school, like hardware type video as well. So very, very good to see that doing well. Evidently it is telling me what my audience actually want. Yeah, I released the next one, 1,700 views. And I appreciate that that's only in, you know, 24 hours-ish. But yeah, it's completely died off now. It's, you know, it's getting like 15, 20 views an hour, which isn't much. I mean, what are these still getting? Yeah, I mean, this one's, look at that. You know, an hour ago, the second desk video got 101 views. So yeah, that's five times as much as the Doom collection. That one's kind of died off. But yeah, so there you go. That's kind of the most recent videos out. But I looked at it and I thought, you know what? I'll experiment because I've released three videos in a row on the main channel. And I thought, well, YouTube likes regular releases, you know, the algorithm and all that. What if I released a fourth video in a row, 4 weeks in a row on the main channel, which is kind of unprecedented for my channel. But I thought, well, you know, keep that momentum up. I've got two videos out there that are doing really well. So let's release something else. So I polished it up even more, edited out some ums and ahs and some, you know, bits where I was rambling. Rambling is perfectly fine on the second channel, but it's not quite so acceptable on the main channel. And, you know, put some, you know, extra sexy shots in there, a bit of extra time on, you know, the transitions and the slow zooms and all that lovely stuff. Put the Patreon credits at the end, of course, because I have the supporter credits on my main channel videos. And I was really pleased with it. I thought, you know, this is quite a cool video. It's should be good for retention. Obviously, I've got the big reveal at the end. And yeah, I mean, the retention's actually quite good on that. It's, you know, a nice flat line, which is what we like to see. But evidently not much kind of wide appeal, which is a bit strange. You know, the people that have watched the past two, I suppose the past two videos have been hardware videos and this one isn't. This is more kind of a game collection type video. So yeah, whether it'll pick up, I'm not sure, but an interesting experiment and probably one that I won't be repeating because I can imagine that's going to have a bit of a knock-on effect on the next video. But I've still got this one that's still doing fantastically well and kind of keeping everything afloat. So that's all good. But just thought I'd talk about that. And yeah, so that's the ramble. That's the latest video. Nothing on the second channel this week. So let's get into some news. So a quick update on one of last week's stories. I mentioned that Apple had announced that they were going to be allowing emulators on the App Store. You could officially download an emulator for retro systems and things and install it on your iOS device, on your iPhone or your iPad. And there was some speculation in kind of the retro community as to what this means, you know, what kind of stuff. Would they only be allowing, like, official stuff? I think I speculated myself that Nintendo might be doing something similar to, like, their virtual console thing and, you know, the old games that they release on the Switch and stuff like that. But yes, something, there has been a very big release around this. I'm not sure if it's the only emulator, but it's certainly the one that everyone's talking about this week. And I thought I would just give it a quick mention. And that's this one, which is called Delta. Now, this is a pre-existing emulator for iOS. So this was called GBA for iOS, and it's been around for quite a while, and you've been able to sideload it if you have a jailbroken iOS device. But it's now officially released, and here it is in the App Store. So, yeah, it does actually say it's the GBA for iOS successor, and it looks really cool, doesn't it? It's got like this really cool on-screen touch controls for the various different systems. So it supports the NES, the SNES, the N64. And the DS, they've got this kind of GameCube style controller here as well, but I don't think it does GameCube games. And yeah, so the way that this works is obviously you have to load up your own ROMs. It doesn't come with ROMs. And in the case of the DS, obviously that has a BIOS and you need to supply your own BIOS file for that. But you can do that. You can use the iTunes file transfer functionality to transfer those files over. And you can also, I believe you can sync it up with Google Drive and it will pick up the ROMs from there as well. And just load up whatever stuff you want. And it's an officially released emulator on iOS. Isn't that very strange? But it looks very cool. Also supports external controllers. Obviously they're supported on the iOS devices as well, but looks like quite a cool thing. Of course, I'm an Android guy myself. And as discussed last week, I don't really play emulators on my phone, but yeah, cool. Good for them. Looks very interesting. Very interesting to see kind of what else comes out for the platform. But of course, because this one's been out for quite a long time now, it's this very kind of finished, polished, really kind of nice product by all accounts. Because, yeah, like I say, it was kind of sideloadable for years. Not just a quick cash grab and kind of a half-assed attempt, which is always nice to see. So, yeah, was reading about that in Ars Technica earlier this week and looks cool. Looks like a nice project. Oh, and while we're here, just another update to a previous story just before we get going. This was a couple of rambles ago I talked about this. StopKillingGames.com, which is a bit of a movement to get publishers to support their games for a reasonable length of time, rather than just sort of shutting the servers down after a couple of years. Of course, everything has some kind of online component. Even single-player games nowadays are tied into servers and things. And when the publisher shut the servers down, the games are unplayable and they're basically lost forever, which, of course, is terrible. And I'll talk a little bit about this thing. Now, I must admit, I will come clean with this. I wasn't really aware that this was quite such a big thing. I had a few people thank me for kind of shining a spotlight on it and putting it out there and kind of helping to do my bit. But it was just something I kind of stumbled across because a couple of people were talking about it. And I wasn't familiar with Ross's channel, Accursed Farms. Obviously, I linked to the video. I had watched the video. It's a very interesting video. Half an hour long, and he kind of talks about the whole story behind this game preservation thing and how online servers and activation and all that stuff kind of works. Great video, and I will link to it again. He has posted a 50-second version in the comments as well for those of you who kind of want the background on this but don't want to watch the whole half an hour thing. But yeah, just to give it another bit of a shout out, because I wasn't really quite sure what to make of it at the time, but thought it sounded important. But now I'm a bit more clued up on it. It is a great thing, and it is something that people should be supporting. And they have now officially launched a petition. So we've got the UK government petition website here, and it's basically asking that they actually kind of debate this in Parliament and kind of form some laws around this whole thing about kind of legally forcing game publishers to actually support their games. And hey, Yeah, it's. I haven't signed it myself yet, but I probably will. I'm kind of still pondering what my thoughts are on this, but it's a thing. We've got a deadline of the 16th of October 2024. If it gets 10,000 signatures, then they will respond to it, and if it gets 100,000, then they will consider it for debate in Parliament, as always, with the parliamentary website. Quite a good system, and it's quite a few things I've kind of been involved with over the years that where I've signed a petition, and it has actually ended up in something happening, which is bizarre in this kind of modern democracy that we live in, but there we go. So anyway, the petition's there. I will link to that in the usual places if you're based in the UK and want to go and sign that. And again, I'll link to the video and the website as well, because I want to spread awareness of this thing. So here's a bit of a weird one. This is something that I saw shared on, I think it was on Mastodon. Yep, I am on Mastodon. I'm not really sort of overly active on there, but I do post on there and do kind of interact with people and stuff. Do like to scroll through at least a couple of times a day. Obviously, I'm on Blue Sky and the other website, the Musky one as well, whatever it's called this week. But yeah, I saw this pop up. Someone I've been following for ages, probably since the very beginning on Twitter, I would have thought. A chap called Benj Edwards. And I thought this was quite an interesting article. This is actually like a blog post on his blog, Vintage Computing and Gaming, which is on vintagecomputing.com. Links in the usual places, as always. And this is a bit about the history of clip art. Of course, you don't see clip art nowadays, do you? Which is, it's a bit of a shame. I remember kind of growing up in the 90s and kind of the early 2000s. You couldn't go into any office or, any kind of local shop without there being some kind of weird homemade sign full of clip art. And what he basically reflects on it and kind of looks a bit at the kind of history of it and how it was used and kind of the different styles and things. I mean, it's not a super in-depth thing. It is quite a long article, though. But he kind of goes through and picks some of his favourite examples and some of his favourite clip art and stuff. And specifically with a view to kind of looking at obsolete technology and fashion and stuff and how it's actually kind of a snapshot of the time that it was made. And I just thought it was quite a cool trip down memory lane, just kind of seeing this, seeing this kind of art style again that we just don't see anymore. He's got picked out some old computers and some like sign templates and stuff like that, old cars and... I'm just kind of scrolling through and saying what I see here, but obsolete technology and things. And just, it's just quite nice. It's quite a quick read, it's not too in-depth or too heavy or anything like that, but I thought it was quite a fascinating thing just to look at and just kind of jogged my memory as to a different time in the world of computing. Now, I remember growing up as a kid and playing with like Microsoft Office, Office 97 and stuff, and obviously you'd have all the clip art on the CD, and you couldn't install it all to your hard drive because you'd have like a, 300 megabyte hard drive or something. You don't want to fill it with like 500 megs worth of clip art or whatever it was. Probably not that much. Someone's going to tell me I'm wrong in the comments, but, and you'd make your little document and you put your little people on there, like the screen beans and stuff like that, and... Yeah, just thought that was nice. And something a little bit different for a change as well. It's not something I've really seen widely publicised. But like I say, been following the guy for years. Interesting article. Go and check it out. So one of the systems I have covered quite in depth on my channel is the original Xbox, because it's a system that I have quite a lot of love for, if I'm honest. And you might think, well, original Xbox, that's not retro, is it? 2001 the original Xbox came out, so it's getting on for 25 years old now. 23 years old, it's like, ooh. It's just us, we're just getting old. But one of my favourite consoles of all time and one of my favourite games of all time. Sorry to be a bit of a normie with this opinion, and I know it's nothing particularly exciting, but one of my favourite game series of all time was Halo. And I say was, because I didn't really play any of them past sort of Halo 3 on the Xbox 360, but... by far one of the best games in that series is Halo 2, the second one. The first one was great, and it was very kind of groundbreaking. Obviously, kind of started off as a Mac game, didn't it? And then Microsoft kind of bought the studio, and it ended up becoming an Xbox exclusive somehow. And it was made by Bungie, who'd made Marathon on the Mac previously. That kind of very important first-person shooter on that system. And then, of course, it went on to be a whole series, and then... the whole thing with 343. I'm not here to give you a complete history of Halo, but love playing this game. Very, very fond memories of LAN parties around friends' houses. At one point, we did have a full 16-player LAN party. I can't remember if that was Halo 2 or Halo 3, but we certainly did. At least four Xboxes with like the four-player split screen on each one, and cables and switches and stuff everywhere, of course, before it was all wireless. And what this Ryan Miceli has done, iCode for Coffee, or iCode4.coffee, great URL. What he's done is he's modified the original Halo 2. And when I say modified, what I mean is he has actually gone in and sort of made some quite big changes to the renderer and stuff, to the actual code. And this article here just goes into quite a lot of detail as to what he's actually done to the game to make these improvements. So he's basically added high definition textures. It unlocked higher resolutions, all of that kind of stuff. Just improved it graphically. Stopped a graphical pop-up. I'm just consulting my notes here. And it's quite a cool project. And there's a really good video at the end of this article, which, of course, I mean, I'll link to the article, and you can scroll down to the bottom and watch the video if you don't want to read it all. Just talks about the changes that he's made and kind of shows them off visually. Stuff like the widescreen support, I never realised that in the original game, I mean, to be fair, I probably didn't have a widescreen TV at the time, but in the original game, the widescreen was actually slightly broken and the aspect ratio was off because of the way that it was kind of rendered and then scaled, which I never realised. And some of the really horrific, like, texture pop-in and stuff, even on, like, some of the cutscenes where you've got people's faces kind of taking up most of the screen and then, like, all of a sudden the texture will pop in, it's like, there was just no way for them to sort of fix that at the time with the way that things were. And yeah, he's gone through and he's added 720p support and all of this. Now, there is quite a big caveat with this. And I started off reading through this and I kind of thought, I want to download this. I'm going to check this out because this looks absolutely amazing on my original Xbox. But it turns out, he's also added the ability to overclock the GPU, which apparently you can do in software. The original game being sort of quite heavily like CPU bound, and then you overclock the GPU and then it becomes like CPU and RAM bound, which you can't really do much about, which obviously is kind of really, really pushing the limits of the system. And does go into a lot of technical detail on why that is and kind of ways that he's kind of tried to work around it. But unfortunately, I'm not in a position to actually test this on my Xbox because you need to have upgraded the RAM. It needs 128 meg of RAM for all the extra texture data and stuff. And the other thing is that another couple of kind of small downsides to this slightly modded version, the UI elements and the on-screen display stuff and all the menus and stuff don't scale because of the way that it's all kind of coded and kind of fixed to a particular resolution that it's actually rendered at natively, which is unfortunate. And he basically kind of says that he's not going to fix that because it's not really worth the monumental effort that it would take to support all the different resolutions. And the other issue being that if you actually run it in 720p mode, the game is basically a slideshow. It's basically just there for taking very pretty screenshots. But still, I thought this was an amazing technical achievement. I mean, a console that's been out for over 20 years and people are still kind of pushing the boundaries of it and kind of taking it apart. Of course, I've got the Stellar mod chip in mine and the Xbox HDMI mod, which I made a video on. I will link to those if you want to have a look at those. I'll probably forget to do that, but there we go. Just another kind of really in-depth technical article that was just really interesting reading. Obviously, you've got examples of code and stuff and how the kind of stuff's rendered to the screen. And yeah, it's easy to kind of write off these kind of later consoles and think, it's just a PC, it's not very interesting, But it is interesting. It's got its own kind of quirks and its own kind of development issues and peculiarities. And it's quite interesting to read about those from someone who's evidently very, very experienced in them and very skilled in kind of working with them and trying to overcome them. So, well, that was a great article and there's a great video attached to that as well. But basically, the long and the short of it is, if you have a modified original Xbox with 128 meg of RAM, and you want to try out this new version of Halo 2, you can. And there's some performance improvements, there's graphics improvements, and just improvements all around, new resolutions, and all of that, as I've previously mentioned. And hey, maybe worth it just for just to be able to play with that GPU overclocking tool that I mentioned. But yeah, cool article that, cool little project. And I like this stuff. I like it when people kind of hack these things and push the limits. Particularly stuff that we think that we know inside and out and we've kind of written off as being a bit boring, like the original Xbox. So I wanted to just take a minute out of this week's ramble just to recognise a fellow member of the YouTube community, the computing YouTube community, I guess, retro computing YouTube community, kind of. Perhaps, I mean, a lot of the stuff that he's covered does kind of fall under that banner just purely by the fact that he's been doing it for such a long time. And this is someone who hit a very big milestone this week, and I just wanted to congratulate him, really, because he's a bit of an inspiration of mine, a fellow kind of British computing YouTuber, and someone who's genuinely a thoroughly nice chap. And that is, of course, Chris Barnett from the channel Explaining Computers. I'm sure you've come across this channel. His presenting style is quite unique on YouTube, in a good way, very much in a good way. No kind of sensationalism and clickbait and drama and that kind of stuff. It's very much like your old Open University style stuff, BBC documentary stuff. Very authoritative, very kind of clear, very sort of well-informed, well-kind of educated stuff. Really, really good, and fantastic to see him doing well and, yeah, hitting that massive milestone of 1 million subscribers, having been uploading videos regularly for 16 years. So there we go. He released a video, and I wanted to show you a clip of this. I'm going to break with tradition slightly and actually play the audio from this because I think it's really lovely, and I just really loved his reaction to it. So, yeah, here is Chris Barnett from Explaining Computers. Just a little clip of him unboxing his gold play button for that huge milestone of 1 million subscribers.
Wow. It's very difficult to put into words what this means. You know, 1 million people have clicked on Explaining Computers to wish to see what's going on with a channel. And here it is in a great big thing to put on the wall. We've got a gold play button. We've got 1 million subscribers, 1 million people as part of the Explaining Computers community. I'm quite overcome, actually. This is a much bigger moment than I thought it was going to be. Here we are, the gold play button for Explaining Computers.
So yeah, congratulations to Chris, a really big milestone and very, very well earned, a really, really excellent channel. Go check out his channel and I will link it in the usual places as per everything else. So some YouTube drama this week. Now, please allow me to explain. I know you're not fans of drama. And to be honest, I don't want to wade into it based on previous experience. That never ends well. But something that came up this week and something that I think is very important to talk about, and I thought the response to this was absolutely spot on. And also a bit of a Streisand effect type thing. Obviously, Barbara Streisand, the Streisand effect, back in the early 2000s, there was some, I don't know the exact details, there was some issue where there was like a photo of her house that was available somewhere and she didn't like it and she started shouting about it in all the press, and actually it just drew attention to the fact that this thing existed when before nobody really knew or cared. And I think this is very much the same with this tweet that's blown up this week concerning a YouTube review. And as someone who does occasionally review things, I thought this was actually highly relevant to me and highly relevant to my audience. And of course, I will talk about my opinions on this as well. But let's have a look at the tweet first, of course, set the scene. Like I say, literally the first I'd heard of this. And it's from someone called Daniel Vassallo. And it says, I find it distasteful, almost unethical to say this when you have 18 million subscribers. Hard to explain why, but with great reach comes great responsibility. Potentially killing someone else's nascent project reeks of carelessness. First, do no harm. And he's posted a screenshot of a review by Marques Brownlee. Now, Marques Brownlee, absolutely brilliant tech reviewer. I love his channel. I watch quite a lot of his stuff, even though I'm not really interested in a lot of the modern stuff that he reviews, but I just really like his videos. And the title of the video is The Worst Product I've Ever Reviewed for Now. And he's wearing this weird little badge thing with like a projector that's projecting $700 onto his hand. And this is the Humane AI pin. Now, Marques has responded to this. I like his initial response, which was just a reply to the tweet, which said, we disagree on what my job is. And yeah, essentially, it seems to be this Daniel guy versus the world. Now, a bit of background information on this Humane AI pin. I just want to talk about what it is as a piece of hardware. So it's supposed to be like a replacement for your smartphone. It's a thing that you clip onto your shirt, and it doesn't have a screen. It uses a projector that you project onto your hand, and you control it by kind of moving your hand around and doing like hand gestures and stuff. And it has the word AI in the name, so of course it's attracted loads of investment from the Silicon Valley venture capitalist crowd, of course, because they want to throw money at anything that has AI in it. And actually, the thing is worse than a smartphone. It's $700 plus a $24 a month subscription. And Marquez did a really thorough review of it, and actually a very kind of impartial and sort of detailed review, just demonstrating everything. He used this thing for a week and basically found that it was very, very slow to respond to stuff. The battery life was really bad, that it basically didn't work at all without a very, very good data connection, because literally it doesn't do any sort of processing on the actual device itself. It's all sent off to this cloud AI thing and then sent back. And yeah, just found that basically that using his smartphone, which he already has with him, was actually sort of faster and easier for 99% of the stuff that he used it for. And it was a very honest review. I quite enjoyed it, and I think it is worth watching if you want to see this. But of course, this guy kind of kicked off and he was like, oh, it's unethical to, you know, this is a startup. Now, there is kind of some Marquez has previous, let's say, in this area. He reviewed a Rivian electric car. Had absolutely loads and loads of issues. And it was, again, another very honest review, but unfortunately a very negative review, because it just had so many problems. And, you know, a lot of those were kind of safety problems that he wanted to draw attention to. And shortly after that, the company actually went bust. And people were saying that, you know, being the biggest tech reviewer in the world, because, I mean, he has a car review channel as well, that he was kind of partly responsible for that, and that he's going to do the same to this company. And actually, you know, this is different. This is a new startup, and this is kind of the darling of all the AI bros on Twitter. And, you know, they all want to see it succeed, even though the device is apparently not very good. He's not the only person to give it a negative review. And yeah, you know, it's very much in line with what everyone else is saying about this thing. But people are singling him out, or this nut job is singling him out. And he's posted a response, which is a 13-minute long video, still up on his channel, the most recent upload on his channel at the time of recording. I sat and watched this as well. And he just talks about how important it is to be kind of honest and impartial in reviews, and some of the like deals that he's turned down and stuff like that. And, you know, how he avoids sort of sponsors that are covering in the same sort of fields as the stuff that he covers and all of that. Also did an interview with Colin and Samir, which came up which off the back of this, which is quite interesting. So it's been really, really big news in kind of the tech review world. But yeah, I just thought this was really interesting, because obviously I do review stuff, and I do sponsored review stuff, and I always try to be honest. And to be honest, I always kind of try to go out of my way to find something negative to say, because I don't want to come across as an advert, like I'm just reeling off what they're telling me to say. I know that's probably a bit unreasonable of me, but it's always been the case if you look at any of kind of the sponsored stuff that I've done. But yeah, I thought the response to this was very strange, because he tested this device. It wasn't very good. He was honest about the bits that didn't work very well. And yeah, there seems to have been this backlash against it. And this whole conversation about, oh, actually reviewers, you know, they need to go easy on some of these companies, because, you know, they're new and they need to be given the benefit of the doubt and all that kind of stuff. And of course, it's rubbish. I mean, it's their job to review stuff and to be honest about it. And if they're not, then that's a massive blow to their credibility. And part of the reason that he has 18 million subscribers is because he has that credibility that he's built up over the years. And he's known as a kind of a very honest person and a very kind of impartial person. So interesting debate around that and around sort of YouTube reviews in general. And yeah, like I say, you know, Marquez, one of the good guys. And there you go. Just wanted to sort of give my thoughts on that whole debacle. And that brings us on to this week's video of the week. And all that. Still no theme tune. Not quite sure how many weeks it's been that I've been doing these videos of the week, and I still haven't got around to recording that theme tune. I will, I promise, one day I will. And it will come completely out of the blue, and it will be amazing, it will be fantastic, and you'll be glad that I've kept you waiting for so long. But anyway, let's talk about the video. And this is a bit of a strange one. This is one that came up as a recommendation on my TV the other night, and I sat and watched it. Pretty much with a very bewildered look upon my face, because it's a very odd, very, very odd one. Channel I'm familiar with, a channel I went through a bit of a stage of watching all of their stuff at one point, because I thought it was quite nice and quite educational. And the channel is, well, I'll show you the channel and I'll show you the video. It's Evan and Caitlin. They are a husband and wife maker team who have their own YouTube channel. They do engineering things and craft things and that kind of stuff. Really lovely pair of people, and you know, come across really well on camera. They make really, really excellent videos. And their latest video is probably the most, or one of the most unhinged projects I've ever had the misfortune to come across on YouTube. And what they've done is they've taken a robot dog. So they bought this robot dog, you know, like the Boston Dynamics. It's not a Boston Dynamics one. It's like a knockoff one. But they've taken one of those and they've attached a Furby to it and made a whole new robotic life form. I say a Furby. It's actually a 3D printed replica of a Furby, which is actually much, much bigger. And the whole build process is absolutely fascinating. They worked together with another channel on this, which unfortunately, what's the name of the guy? Austin Bradley. There we go. Skipped to exactly the right point of the video. Well done, Reese. And he 3D prints all of these cursed Furby things. But yeah, if you're interested in you know, robotics and programming stuff and 3D printed stuff and craft stuff and just completely complete and utter nightmare fuel, I'm not going to show you the end of this video because you really need to see it for yourself. It's a great video. It's a great project. 23 minutes long, worth sitting down in front of the TV with a beer or maybe something stronger. And just seeing how the madness unfolds. One of the most kind of unique and weird things that I've seen on YouTube. And I thought it was a really cool project and just wanted to sort of... just sort of shout it out. So yeah, check that out if you haven't already. I know I posted it on my Discord server earlier this week, but wanted to kind of shove this in front of some more people and ruin their dreams. But anyway, that's all I have for you this week. Thank you ever so much for listening. I need to go and tidy up this huge pile of Doom stuff that I've still got spread about the place. And also start testing something for another video. I've got quite an interesting piece of hardware that I'm quite keen to get on with and sort of show off in the next video. Maybe that'll be the next main channel video. Not quite sure. I'll have to see how well that experimentation goes. But thank you ever so much once more for joining me and have a wonderful weekend. And I shall see you next week at 2 minutes to midnight on Friday night UK time for another ramble. Okay.